It's 3 o'clock on my phone, so it's time to start University Council. That was the call to order, Roman numeral one. And now, Pat, can you verify that we have a quorum?
We do have a quorum.
Wonderful. May I have a motion to adopt the agenda? And please mention your name when you make the motion so we can get it in the minutes. Thank you. Thank you. We have a motion and a second. All in favor? Any opposed? I didn't ask for discussion, but I didn't see anyone run to the microphone to discuss, so we'll keep moving. Roman numeral four is approval of the January 31st minutes found on pages 3 to 5 of the packet. May I have a motion to approve? All right, second. Thank you. Any discussion? All in favor? Any opposed? And I will abstain because I was not here. All right. Have we had any requests for public comment?
No public comment.
All right. In that case, I will move forward with my comments. And I'm going to be talking largely about state budget season. Yay. And just so you can all feel sorry for me, I will be driving to Springfield tonight, spending tomorrow in Springfield, and then driving to O'Hare and flying out tomorrow night. So it is indeed that season, but it's important. State budget season is officially underway. And just to remind everybody of where we are in the process, in November, our own Board of Trustees approved a fiscal year 25 budget request of $116.4 million. And this was done fully well knowing that receiving that amount was highly unlikely. We have not received what we have passed as the Board of Trustees in probably as many years as I've been here. Last month, the recommendation from the Illinois Board of Higher Education regarding higher education's fiscal year 25 appropriation provided for an appropriation of $106.4 million to NIU, which would have been $10 million less than the Board of Trustees request, but would have been a 7.8% increase over last year. And we were very, very happy to see that. But again, we did not expect that level of funding to be realized in the budget proposed by the governor for higher ed, because the executive branch started signaling very early this year that it would be a lean budget year, given the demands on the state and the disappearance of COVID relief funding. In the governor's proposed fiscal year 25 budget, there was a commendable commitment to supporting higher education in this challenging fiscal climate. There was a proposed 2% increase in appropriated funds for operations at NIU and the other public universities, as well as continued stable support for AIM High and a $100 million increase to MAP. So that will have real positive impact on our students, and the stable funding for AIM High, the increase to MAP, and the increase in Pell that we saw is what allowed us to actually raise the ceiling on the Husky Pledge. And so that was very, very positive news for the students of NIU. The governor's budget also contains an additional allocation for deferred maintenance in the fiscal year 25 capital budget. And that was welcome news. The governor had signaled about a month ago that we wouldn't see a big increase in operating funds, but the executive branch was going to try to do something extra in capital. It's $450 million extra dedicated to public universities. And we think that will translate to about $54 million for NIU. So these are steps in the right direction, but they don't fully address the escalating costs of inflation. And so we're going to have some continued financial hurdles, and we're continuing to work on those. And you'll hear about that from Lori Elsh-Piper and George Middlemiss later. But I also want to remind you that the governor's address is still only the first step in the state budget process once the legislative session starts. And the legislative session will continue through May. It will involve budget hearings and negotiations before a final budget is approved. The key dates for NIU that are related to the normal budget cycle are next week, March 5th, is NIU Advocacy Day. This is when our very dedicated alums go to Springfield with some members of the leadership and just talk about the positive impact of NIU on them, their communities, the value of our public mission, the value of the university overall. And it's very important for legislators to hear from people who live in their districts who don't work for the university about the value of the university. So it's always a very positive day. March 14th is the higher education reception in Springfield. That's when all of the presidents and chancellors, the members of higher ed advocacy groups, the legislators who and staffers who populate the higher ed related committees, the governor's office, etc., get together, and there's a lot of networking done there. You always get good intel on what's going on behind the scenes, and there's an opportunity to make your case in an informal setting. And then we are testifying back-to-back days this year. April 10th will be our Senate Higher Education Appropriations Hearing, and April 11th will be the House Higher Education Appropriations Hearing. And the relatively good news in all of this is that although there will be strong partisan disagreements on some aspects of the governor's proposed budget, there appears to be bipartisan support for funding higher education at the recommended levels. So we don't expect a big fight over the appropriated funds, the MAP, the AIM High, et cetera. In addition to this kind of routine level of Springfield activity associated with the state budget, this session, the General Assembly will also be contemplating action on recommendations put forward by the Commission on Equitable Public University Funding. And I think I've spoken to the group about this before. After 2 years of work, the commission held its 15th and final meeting yesterday. Last week, commissioners had their last chance to submit feedback on a draft version of the report. And there are plans at this point for the final draft to be released on March 1st and then presented formally at a press conference in Springfield on March 6th. There is a strong will among many who invested countless hours on the commission to have action taken this legislative session, meaning that there is adoption of an equitable adequacy-based model for funding higher ed and a plan for funding the model over time, because having a model is only good if the money actually follows the model. And we've seen this with the evidence-based formula for funding K-12. At this point, though, I will say for the higher ed model, what having a model and funding to follow it actually means isn't perfectly clear because we haven't seen the final report and because there were some items left open for the General Assembly to decide after commissioners failed to find common ground. I want to say that I am really proud of the commitment across our state to address longstanding inequities in our higher education system. And I'm also really proud of the myriad ways that NIU contributed to the conversation and debates about how to achieve adequate, equitable, and stable funding for Illinois public universities. And I'm particularly proud of our NIU advocacy for including research and community engagement as critical elements of the university's missions. And I also really hope that lingering non-trivial concerns that we have about how resources other than tuition and state support are factored can be addressed as the report's recommendations advance through the legislative process. One of the undecided issues was how to count philanthropy and endowment and whether that should be expected to fund routine university operations. There were assumptions made that don't match the reality of NIU or other universities. And so this was a point of contention, and I expect it will be a continued point of discussion as the recommendations of the report are taken forward in the legislative process. I want to also recognize that in addition to me, other Huskies served. Andrew Rogers and Beth Ingram served on the commission's technical working group. And Simone Weffer Elizondo, who represented the faculty of Illinois. So even though he was a Husky, he wasn't there as a Husky. He was there representing the faculty of Illinois. Simone served on the technical working group. the Adequacy Working Group, which I was also part of, and then the commission itself. And I've actually asked Simone here to talk about the commission process and product from his viewpoint, because he was very intimately involved in the final stages, the technical working group stages, where a lot of the rubber hit the road. So I'm going to turn it over to Simone now.
Thank you, but I'll step over here. Thanks everyone for taking the time. I appreciate it. It was really an honor to serve in this capacity, to represent NIU, to represent faculty, to represent the Latinx community. And so a little bit of background, the effort to get to a funding model for higher education came out of a strategic plan that IBHE created for the next 10 years that both President Freeman and I served on 3 years ago-ish, COVID-ish, yes, definitely all online. But out of that strategic plan came three pillars for funding for higher education: equity, adequacy, and stability. And so, as you can imagine, those three dynamics don't play well with one another at all times. And so the difficulty in creating any formula is balancing those competing interests. And there was a lot of discussion on these things, not just because I'm the DEI director for the college, but because working on diversity, equity, and inclusion work is what I do generally. I had to often push back on the ideas of equity, right? There were people that were all for equity until actually equity cost something, right? And so it was really trying at times. And there were flaws in the process, and there's flaws in any model, because any of us that do quantitative modeling know there is no perfect model, right? All we can do is create something as a starting point and then hopefully make it better. And so we created this framework overall. And this came out of both the larger working group and then the sub work group on adequacy, resources, and then the technical working group. And so you can see that in trying to capture everything that makes up ensuring that the university can turn on its lights and teach, we came up with these various, some of them look small, but are actually very large categories, right? So instruction and student services, which includes student-centered access, academic supports, non-academic supports, core instructional programs. And then you have the mission, research, public service, and artistry. And I have to say, this was one of the hardest things to capture in any model, because how do you say what a university's mission is quantitatively, right? So we can capture some of these things like research. We can kind of capture that. We can put a number on that. Kind of, even though we know that research is much more expensive than any single dollar amount put in, for those of us that have written grant proposals. And artistry, right? How do we put a number on art? I mean, that's a question for my colleagues in philosophy, but a larger issue overall. And then we didn't even capture, I don't think, adequately, and Beth and I worked on this mission component, like the other parts of being a university, especially for us as regional institutions. What do we mean for our region? What does it mean when we bring a speaker, or we bring an art installation, or we bring a musical group that would not normally stop in DeKalb, right? Or out in Western, or in Southern, or maybe even UIC, depending on the group, right? So, you know, that was very difficult. And then we have, you know, operations and maintenance, which might only be two words, but those of you that work in that arena know exactly how broad it is. And so it created this adequacy target and then this resource profile. And then based on current state appropriations, what we defined as the equitable student share, which is the amount a student pays towards their education, or in this case, sort of the aggregate amount that students pay towards their education at the institutional level. And then other resources, typically that's things like philanthropy or other amounts of funding. And then it gives us a gap, right? And as a shock to no one, no university is adequately funded based on this model. I will let you guess some other time, not in open session, which university is closest and which is farthest. We can play that drinking game at Fatty's, perhaps, but we won't discuss it here. Could you go to the next slide, please, Pat? So then we started to actually have to build a model. And I will say this, I am biased as a quantitative sociologist and sitting there with Beth as an economist. When we think model, we think of something much more complex, things with regressions, you put in this amount and it changes this amount. Really what we developed was a headcount model, which is lots of little cells and we're multiplying by different amounts. But we started with some base student costs. And we started building in, okay, based on what we have from IBHG data or self-reported data from the institutions, how can we get at student-centered access? How can we get at academic and non-academic supports, right? So we started building, well, I shouldn't say we, I should say the consulting company that worked with us started building these numbers for us. And then we started adding in just some base numbers for research, for artistry, and then other numbers for operations and maintenance. I will say, and President Freeman mentioned this in her remarks, deferred maintenance is not anywhere in here. That got kicked, that can got kicked, I don't know, really far down the road. Okay, they did not want us dealing with it, in part because just the sheer number of that on the statewide scale would have blown up any discussion about the model. So that's not in there, and we can talk about some other things that we're not sure about if it's in or out of the model. Then we started creating some adjustments. So adjustments in terms of, let's just take the research factor, right? So while it's a $600 base for, say, master's institutions, as an R2 per student, we would get an additional $700 allocated in our state allocation towards research. Okay. This was actually surprisingly became a very contentious part of the discussion in the last couple meetings of the larger group. I think both President Freeman and I were a little surprised by it, in part because there was some argument that it wasn't equitable, even though if you were to look at IBHE data for the last several years, master's level institutions were only getting about $45 per student for research. And so Beth and I thought that bumping them up to 600, because we know how important research is in terms of future trajectory for students, especially if we're looking to, say, recruit them into our master's and PhD programs, having that research base is extremely important. You know, I mean, we probably shortchanged our own institution here with only a $700 bump, but as you know, anyone that's been in these sorts of working groups, you trade things here and there to get other things. But so that's how we started doing it. And so there's different adjustments. And what you don't see here, there are adjustments specifically on issues of race, first gen status, rural status, I feel like I'm missing something, low socioeconomic status, and then students that meet multiple of those factors, right? And this is in part because the legislation itself that created this working group specifically said we need to address long-term persistent racial inequality in higher education and in Illinois. And so it's not here, but when the final report comes out, you will be able to see what the adjustment is for a school like NIU that's very diverse, that says, okay, it is going to cost you more to be able to educate certain groups because they are not coming in as prepared, or as a low-income student, what does that mean to the institution in terms of what the institution needs to provide for them to be successful? So these elements are in there. So those are the equity elements. The other part of this model and the way it works, much like the EBF, and I will say this, for those of you that don't know the K-12 funding model in Illinois, it's changed a lot. And one of the challenges for our group was we got asked to do something in 2 years that it took 20 years to do at the K-12 level in Illinois. So we were 18 years behind, essentially. But I think we did okay. If you could go to the next slide, please. So what does this mean in the aggregate? I'll get to the punchline first. The adequacy gap between where we're at in state appropriations and where we should be as a state is $1.5 billion with a B dollars. Now, some of you chuckled. I'm not going to point out who, right? There were some in the room when we presented this number that were shocked. But again, many of us with a quantitative background knew that two decades plus of underfunding higher education is not going to make the gap like this. It's going to make the gap like this. And so part of the challenge is going to be, I think, for us collectively, and this is the social movement scholar in me coming out, how do we effectively advocate downstate so that the number that goes towards getting towards adequacy is more than just a pittance? Because the reality is EBF has never been fully funded for K through 12, although they are making strides. And the idea is for every new dollar that comes in, some portion would go to those universities furthest from adequacy first, and then work its way towards those that are closest to adequacy. And so for me, while in a purely equitable framework that works because you're starting to get the most disadvantaged help sooner, in a 14 unit or 14 institution setup, what happens to those that are closer to the middle? When will they start getting dollars? And while there is a hold harmless provision, which says, I think as of last year or 2 years ago, that funding number won't decrease. The reality is we know that inflation is impactful, both on the individual micro and macro level. And so if, say, institution A is right there in the middle, and they are still at 2024 funding, but inflation is increasing and they're not getting new dollars, are we really creating an equitable model? And so the importance becomes pushing the governor and pushing the General Assembly to get us to numbers that close that adequacy gap faster rather than slower. And these are big numbers. I mean, I think the final report will have, how many digits will that be? A suggestion of a 9-digit number per year in terms of increases for higher education. And, you know, some people kind of like choked. But again, those of us that had been in the numbers knew that the number was going to be huge. And again, that's without deferred maintenance. One other thing that we grappled with, and just to mention, it doesn't impact us directly, but, well, two things that really need to be explored. One that impacts us more is graduate education. I don't think we spent enough time as a technical working group on technical or on graduate education and all the variety of it, right? It's fundamentally different to be talking about funding someone in the law school versus an EdD versus an MA versus a PhD, right? And so we never got into that. And similarly, we didn't delve into the more expensive MA programs, for example, when we think about high cost programs like engineering, and also think about how do we deal with diversity and diversifying some of those areas that are both high cost but not very diverse. And then the other is medical education. And while we have a part of that with nursing, when you look specifically at colleges of medicine, they are extremely, extremely expensive. And once you start putting them in the model gets even bigger. So while it doesn't impact us generally, it's going to impact the discussions around graduate education, around healthcare education generally, which does have an impact on us. So I'll stop there. I'm happy to try and walk through some of these numbers if you like, or just take some more general questions if anyone has them. Or I'm happy to sprint out of here with no questions. That's fine too. Yeah.
Thank you for sharing all of this kind of inside how the sausage is made process. Mm-hmm. And I know the report's not even out yet, but is there in the report recommendations for processes to update the underlying model, or is this something that is a scale model?
No. So we did include processes for updating the model. We also have discussions in there about when we start thinking about reevaluating the model. So for example, when we start thinking about things like equity and increasing the number of, say, African-American graduates in Illinois from a four-year institution, right? Just putting more money this year is not going to lead to results next year. I think all of us know that. It's going to be 4, 5, 6 years down the road. And so we've included some of those discussions. But again, this is something where the General Assembly is going to hold a lot of the details in terms of that, and I suspect it's going to look very similar to what the K-12 model looks like in that sense.
And I just want to add that one of the things that they did in the K-12 model that they will also do in this model is accountability measures won't really be enforced until the money flows. So you can't start being held accountable while you're not getting additional dollars, which I think is a reasonable feature of the model.
And I think, you know, the two things we also built in, because this was another subsection that I worked on, making sure there was a seat at that table for every institution. So no one can feel like they were left out of the conversation of when the model was being tweaked or updated. And because we know that if you change one variable here, it could lead to 10 million more for this campus, but, you know, 8 million less for another campus. And so we really wanted to embed that. There's a discussion about including students in part of the process, but I think one of the difficulties is, right, this process is going to be so long out, which, you know, we could seat a student now. They might never actually sit on the actual committee. So we had suggested, I had suggested that it might make sense to have graduate student representation. They tend to be around a little longer. They tend to see these things a little bit more, and it actually might impact their professional development as well, especially those that study higher ed or finance. And I'm happy to have conversations over dark liquors anytime about this.
And I guess the other thing I would add is, you know, there was a real desire to move this model forward. And, you know, part of that is we know that we have a fairly friendly administration to higher ed now, and people have worked very hard on this. And that meant that some of the other conversations that need to happen at the same time, the model may be delayed a little bit, but there are things that we can collectively do to help our students have more affordable education and also decrease the overall cost, which will help our own budget and the adequacy gap. So things like advocating for shared purchasing, things like making MAP more flexible so it can be used for all the things Pell can be used for and not just for tuition and fees, asking the state to let us manage our own building projects rather than forcing us to go through the Capital Development Board, which prolongs the timeline, and time is money in this inflationary environment. So all of those things are also on our legislative agenda, but it's unclear how much attention they'll get in Springfield, because this is a big thing. But we're going to try to keep moving everything forward, because you would think when you look at a very large price tag, you would say, well, what else can we do to be efficient and try to bring that adequacy gap down through expense reduction?
And I think, you know, one last thing to hit is that if you look at that bottom line, that bottom left-hand box here, it's basically, if we get to fully funded some point down the line, it will fundamentally flip the responsibility in terms of student education from essentially 60% or more at many campuses on the student to more than 60% on the state. And that's essentially taking us, you know, moving forward or going backwards to move forward, right? We're going back to an older concept. And I will say, you know, there were a bunch of what I termed formula adjacent issues that still need to get worked out. And I just to bring it up here, one was actually increasing the diversity of the faculty pool. I actually, in truth in advertising, I advocated to get that out of this model, because this model did not have a way to be accountable to say, if we give a university $10 million to increase their diversity in their faculty, that we can actually measure that. And so I actually advocated for strengthening the programs we have and creating new programs like strong postdoctoral programs, like, for some of you might know, the University of California postdoctoral program, where you get hired at as a postdoc for 2 years. If you get hired at another UC, your salary is paid centrally for the 5 years. If you go up and get tenure, then you go on the books. So for example, we get a postdoc from U of I here at NIU. They're not on our books for 5 years. They get tenure and then they become on our books. And so it's kind of like you can diversify your faculty for free, at least initially. But programs like that's one thing. But also the point about MAP can't be underscored enough. Needing to increase MAP and needing to make it more flexible and look more like Pell. because we know that particularly for our students, that last dollar really does make a difference. And if MAP isn't covering things like housing, that's a serious impediment, childcare, transportation. I mean, the list goes on and on. And there were some people that threw, for example, room and board out like on the first or second meeting, which was to me unconscionable, but it became one of those things where they weren't going to move. So we just had to find other ways to try and build in funds to help our students. So, but yeah, there's lots to discuss and happy to discuss with anyone that wants to in the future, but thank you so much.
Thank you, Simone. And, you know, certainly as the process moves forward, if there are opportunities for advocacy from our faculty, staff, and students, we will keep the campus updated on the progress and on those opportunities. And I also, before I turn the gavel and the microphone over to Ben, Simone reminded me when he talked about the importance of diversifying our faculty that I want to give a great shout out to Dr. Janice Hamlet and to everyone on this campus who participated in the Preparing Future Faculty of Color conference that took place over the weekend. We had an incredible number of diverse scholars from across our Illinois institutions who aspired to be doctorates, aspired to be faculty in disciplines ranging from arts and humanities to science. And it was just really a wonderful opportunity to interact with those aspiring faculty members, but also to recognize, exclusive of this formula, there are things we as a state can do to come together and support those aspiring faculty members in a very, very meaningful way. So stay tuned on that as well. And with that, I think we're going to move to number 7, new business, and that's where I give Ben Creed the gavel.
All right. Thank you. We don't have any new business, but we do. So that moves us to item 8, which is items for University Council consideration. And so we're going to continue on the theme of dollars, and we're going to have a budget update from Vice President for Administration and Finance and Chief Financial Officer George Middlemist and the Interim Executive Vice President and Provost Lori Ellis Piper. So welcome you up.
Then Lori will join me in a minute. When I get towards the part where we talk about the work that we're doing to mitigate the deficit. But let's see if I can actually use the clicker. I can. Woohoo. So just a couple of updates for y'all today. The first one is just kind of updating you about the Board of Trustees, the FACFO meeting, some of the actions that we took in terms of tuition pricing, room and board pricing, and then we'll get into some of the work that we've been doing in terms of trying to reduce the budget deficit. So with that, I think that it's always good to kind of ground our conversation about revenue pricing and what are the things that we can do when we're talking about revenues at the university. So you've seen this slide before. This just really shows where our money comes from, right? And you can see here that we get about 25% from the state of Illinois, what we were just talking about. A lever that hopefully will be used to the benefit of the university. You can see that about 20% of our revenues come from sales and services, and those are things that here on campus. So things like housing, dining, some of the retail dining. Those are big drivers in terms of those revenues. When you think about the levers you can pull on those, you know, you want to, one, always be thinking about how do you maintain affordability for the things that we do, but also keeping the spaces fresh, clean, vibrant as best as we can. What are our market competitors doing? And so as we think about pricing recommendations in those areas, those are things that really drive our thought process. You can see other things like interest income. And you know, there's not a lot that we do there in the other. And then you see the biggest part of the pie, which really goes to what Simone was just talking about, is our students. So 20 years ago, it was not the biggest part of the pie. The biggest part of the pie was that green thing. And so again, when we're thinking about pricing recommendations on our students or our tuition and fees, it's really thinking about how do we maintain affordability, but also continue to provide the important services, teaching to our students and not harm that as well. And the other things that we really think about as we're talking about pricing recommendations are things like truth in tuition, right? So when we increase tuition rates, that's only on incoming freshmen or incoming students. The revenues that you derive aren't as much as you would think because it's a smaller population of students. So that's kind of the thought process. There's just another way of kind of looking at this. This just kind of shows it in magnitude. How the money comes in, and you can see the square is square. I'm challenged in geometry. The circle on the left is the governmental funding, right? And so that's the state of Illinois appropriation. That's things like the Aim High Match. So that's direct money that's coming from the state of Illinois to the university. You see that little overlap, and those are funds that actually go to our students but are coming from government. So things like Pell, things like MAP, are going directly to students, but then coming to us in forms of payments for tuition fees. And then you can see in students in the red circle in the middle, that's 57% of all the revenues when we think about room and board, fees, tuition. And so that's a giant source of revenue. And then you see the little itty bitty circles to the right. And so the one circle that's kind of blue, those are things that we do in the region. So we have contract services that we provide, maybe certificate programs for businesses where we charge revenues. You can see there's a little overlap because we do have community members come here and park on campus. They pay for parking. And so there's a little bit of overlap in there. And then that last circle is just kind of other stuff. So that thing that we were talking about, investment income, foundation revenue resources, game guarantees. So just little bits of other things. The overlap are things like our hotel, hotel sales to the community, and then camps and conferences. So those are really the sources of our revenue. So that gets us into the pricing recommendations. Again, we really tried to balance the impact and affordability for our students with the needs of the different operations. So our recommendation for room and board was to have an average increase of about 5.3%. It's not quite that high in some of our other, Neptune, where it doesn't have air conditioning for students. I think that was a 3.6% recommendation. But overall, 5.3% will really, what housing needed to be able to continue to provide the best services to our students on housing and dining. And then for undergraduate tuition, we recommended an increase of 4.5% on the base tuition rate. We recommended no increase in any of the differential rates, but for the base rate on tuition, 4.5%. Again, this is only charged to incoming students. It's not charged to all students. And I want to really emphasize that as we do this, we really dig into what this looks like for students. And so as we were having these conversations, we used a modeling tool for scholarships that would really help us understand how we could have the least impact on the students that were the most vulnerable. And so as a part of that, we recommended increasing the Aim High Husky Pledge family contribution from $75,000 to $100,000. So more students will qualify for the Husky Pledge. When we modeled that out, it actually showed us that it drove revenues up at the university because more students would qualify for this and drove the costs down for students. And you can see here in that next bullet, currently today, 43.1% of our students pay no tuition or fees. We expect that number to grow a little bit because of the change to Aim High Pledge, but it has a net positive impact on the university. And so I'm really excited to use this tool to help us. As Simone talked about, no tools that are quantitative are perfect, but we'll be able to model out some different decisions. We'll talk a little bit about that.
I just want to make sure everybody knows what the Aim High Husky Pledge is and what that 75 and 100,000 is. Aim High Husky Pledge is a program that we're able to do because of the Aim High funding we get from the state. We do have an institutional match for it, and it's a last dollar in program. So our institutional funds and the Aim High funds help students achieve that goal of no tuition and fees after MAP and Pell are factored in. When we launched the program, we launched it so that no student whose family income was $75,000 or less would have to pay tuition and fees. So changing from 75 to 100,000 means that more students will be eligible because no student whose family income is $100,000 or less will have to pay tuition and fees. I just wanted to make sure that was clear to everybody. You and I think about this all the time, but
yeah, for a year anyway. The bottom line, I'm an accountant, right? So bottom line for a student is a student that pays all tuition and fees would see an increase in their tuition of about $220 a semester. Again, we're doing lots of work to make sure that we not impact the students that are at risk or the margins. For graduate tuition, we recommended no tuition increases. You know, again, we have drivers, cost drivers, but it didn't. As we had conversations, there's a lot of work happening in the graduate realm around what the right price points are for tuition for the different programs, what the waivers should look like, what scholarships should look like, graduate assistance. So there's so much going on in the graduate programs. It didn't feel like we should just be, hey, we want to increase tuition and then maybe come back in a year and have a different recommendation. So let's wait a year and get through some of the work that's happening, and then we'll have maybe a more strategic and thoughtful recommendation for graduate tuition. And then the last thing are student fees. And so with student fees, we actually have a committee that's made up of students, faculty, and staff. And they get together and start their process in usually the start of the fall semester. And they go out to all the different fee areas and ask what are the fees that they would like to have. And they ask them for metrics. Why are you asking for an increase in fee? What is the driver? Are you trying something new? Are you implementing something? Is it costs? And then they really get into deep conversations about what fees should go up and what shouldn't. They came forward with a recommendation to myself and Lori and Dr. Freeman to increase six fees. The overall increase for the fees is about 5.1%, bottom line accountant guy, $57 a semester. Again, really, as we had these conversations, trying to figure out how we continue to provide the best support and services to our students, but then also maintain some affordability. So I like, although if you're sitting in the back, it's going to be hard to see, but I like showing this slide. On the left, you see this is the undergraduate tuition and fees for every university in Illinois that's a public institution. And the red is Northern Illinois. And so you can see that we're kind of at the bottom half of tuition and fees currently with all the other universities. And that's as of this year. When we increase the tuition and fees, if we assume that nobody else increases their tuition and fees, which is unlikely, then that would move us up to just above Southern Illinois University Carbondale and still kind of in the middle. The thing that I think is also really important to point out with that column or that set of data is that this includes not just tuition and fees, but also student health insurance, which is a mandated fee, but students can opt out of it if they have comparable insurance. And so it's not exactly, if you look at it, $15,000. The other thing I think is really important for us to always remind ourselves, is we have narrative around affordability for students. NIU has historically been very proactive in being affordable for students. And you can see from fiscal year 2016 to 2024, our tuition and fees has gone up 5.1%, which is the lowest of any university in the state of Illinois. And actually, it's not particularly close. When we look just at tuition, you can see that we're ninth currently in terms of where we sit. Again, if nobody else increases tuition, which is unlikely, when we increase our tuition, it will go up slightly above Chicago State University. So we'll sit at about fifth. Still affordable. And you can see here on the other slide that tuition over the last 8 years has increased 3.4%. So again, not the lowest. University of Illinois Springfield is lower than we are because they bump up a lot of their fees. One of the lowest, second lowest. So that's the recommendations that we made to FACPO. All the recommendations were approved at the FACPO special meeting or the Board of Trustees special meeting. And with that, I'm going to jump into kind of where we are with the deficit, and I'll work with my partner in this effort.
And so this slide may look familiar to you. We shared this in the fall semester as to how we wanted to work across campus to develop a set of strategies to address the budget deficit by engaging all members of the community and specifically developing plans in collaboration with all of the divisions to make sure that we were looking at the various levers that we could pull that would make sense, knowing that different divisions have different opportunities, different needs, different challenges. And so within that, really thinking about in this process, what can we do to increase revenue? And some of the types of things that we might be able to do to increase revenue would be new sources of revenue, new programs or new offerings or new initiatives. But at the same time, thinking about how we might need to reallocate some resources in order to grow that revenue. There's something we could do that would generate revenue, but we need to invest more in it, and coming up with a plan to figure out where that investment could come from. And then in addition to that, thinking about revenue, you know, really when you think back to that slide that George shared that showed the critical component that student tuition and fees, that, you know, students obviously from a financial standpoint play an important role in this process, but ultimately that is our purpose as an institution, is to help students come to NIU and complete their degrees and go on to reach their goals and do great things. And so what can we do to increase recruitment to get more students to come to NIU, but also what can we do to increase retention, to make sure that our students are successful and that they're persisting in their programs and that they go on to graduate from their degree programs. And so in thinking about that revenue piece, there were a lot of different components, and some of them, for example, might be more aligned in academic affairs, but thinking about student recruitment and retention, there are many divisions that contribute to that. So many of these goals required collaboration, not just across units or departments, but across not just a couple of divisions, but multiple divisions. So it's been kind of complex in that process. Yeah. A lot of conversations, a lot of planning. And then the other piece of the equation is we have to reduce expenses. We can't just rely on generating new revenue. We also have to look at what our opportunities are to reduce our expenses. Are there things we could stop doing, or that we could do more efficiently, or that we could automate or digitize to be more efficient and to save resources in that regard? Are there things that we could do by reallocating resources that would then result in decreased costs? So trying to think of the whole range of things that we might do, knowing that as a university and so many different moving pieces and parts in a university, that there wouldn't be a single set of strategies, but that those would depend upon what the different divisions are doing. So George and I have been doing meetings with all of the divisions. So we got plans from all of the divisions late in December and early in January, and we went through all of those, and we've been following up with each of the divisions to drill more deeply into what their plans are, to ask questions, to try and identify and calculate the financial impact of revenue generation strategies, or the specific opportunities with reallocation of resources, or the savings that might come about from different kinds of cost or expense reduction. And so we're pretty far into the process. We've met with a lot of divisions. But the challenge becomes when you meet with one division and then you realize that the strategy spans two or three more, you know, bringing all those pieces together. So this slide at a high level identifies some of the opportunities that we have been really drilling into and working on, not just identifying what we can do this year, but thinking across multiple years, because many strategies span multiple years. And then also thinking about different kinds of budget funds. So many times we think of just our O2 or our generally allocated funds, and that certainly is an important component, but depending on the division or the unit, we might have significant revenue that's coming in through auxiliaries, or we might have significant locally generated revenue that would come in through a 41 account, or we might have student fees that might come in through an O4 account, or we might have foundation funds, or we might be thinking about our indirect cost recovery funds and what those are being used for. So in this process, really thinking about not just what's going on with those O2 funds, but thinking about all the different funds and how can we most strategically use those for the most impactful reasons, and to really build a plan across those different types of funds. So it's been a complex process, but on this slide, we've got some broad strategies that we've been able to identify. The first one I'm going to talk about, and then I'm going to hand off to George for a moment, is we've really been looking at the strategic use of scholarships and really being strategic and intentional in awarding scholarships to make sure we're providing the support that students need, but we're doing it in a really strategic way that makes a lot of sense for us. And so a few minutes ago when President Freeman was talking about like last dollar scholarships, like what gets awarded first, what gets awarded second, you know, how are we leveraging foundation scholarships? You know, where do those come in the equation? You know, as we're making decisions on awarding to students, making sure that we're not doing those things out of sequence in a way that doesn't make sense. And so we've been looking at a lot of components related to scholarships and also thinking about, you know, the impact, for example, of the Husky Pledge in terms of, you know, expanding that. What is the impact of that? So the scholarship conversations continue. We just had a little lunch yesterday where we kind of worked through some more dealing with making sure that we're awarding the foundation scholarships as they're intended, making sure that we are, you know, identifying those qualified students and awarding those and doing that in a timely manner, improving our processes so that some of those dollars don't sit there unawarded when there might be a deserving qualified student. And so that's some of the work we've been doing. I'm going to be quiet for a minute and hand it off to George for probably a more technical interpretation.
I'm an accountant, right? So specifics. And I neglected to say something that's really important in the revenue equation, right? So price is one part of the revenue equation, but Lori is talking about the most important part, which is the sales. If we can retain our students, if we can recruit students, that generates a lot of revenue. So a lot of the strategies that we've been looking at is around what can recruit and what can retain students. And so I'll give a specific example so that you know that we're not just talking at broad levels, that we're actually in doing work. We've used that scholarshiping tool to look at a merit scholarship that we give to students. So right now, incoming students, incoming freshmen that have this scholarship get a $3,000 scholarship right up front. This is your scholarship for coming to the university. What we've done is we've looked at that scholarship and have seen that the retention is not as strong for those students in years 2, 3, and 4. And so using the modeling tool, are changing that scholarship to a $4,000 scholarship, but paid over the 4 years, so $1,000 a year. And what the modeling is showing us is that we'll actually keep the same number of students. We won't lose students by reducing the first year amount from 3,000 to 1,000, but we're retaining those students over the life of the 4 years at a much better rate. And so that'll generate actually about $750,000 we're estimating in revenues. We'll see as we compare what we predict to what we actually have happened. But we're using data to make those decisions, right? And so that's one example. When Lori talks about the efforts that we're doing with the foundation, we have a significant amount of money, over $1 million, that doesn't always get used in the foundation scholarships for lots of reasons. So how we can, you know, drive some of that to help with the scholarship expense. And so those are just two examples in terms of the scholarships. You know, we all heard Catherine's presentation yesterday on the campaign, right? Fundraising is a critical component to us helping to resolve the deficit. It won't be perfect. I mean, it's going to take time, but there's a lot of that that's going on. And then I actually am going to turn it over to Lori, because there's a specific example that we have in renegotiating contracts to reduce expenses. So when we see things that aren't working quite as well, we've renegotiated contracts so that we can still serve our students, but maybe at a lower cost. I was thinking of Braven.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Maybe we won't use that one.
Yeah. Something that might be happening.
Yeah. We're working really hard to, we do have a program that will generate revenues with McKendree Community College. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's an example of a new initiative. And so you may have heard that we have a partnership with McHenry County College. They're anxious to have us deliver degree completion programs on their campus for location-bound working adults in 5 degree areas. And so those will be new students that we will be serving who would not have been able to come to our campus to complete a degree here. And so really looking at those strategic opportunities, which will increase our enrollment, and through that partnership also allow us to serve that area and to help in some high need areas where they really need people to earn these degrees. And so we're excited to launch those 5 degrees. And then also we have the partnership with Harper, where we've been delivering degrees for a few years in a similar model. We're going to be adding a new degree program. One of the degrees was not in as high a demand, and so we've taught out the students who were interested in that degree, and we're going to be adding at least one more high demand degree. So really looking at those opportunities to serve students in different ways to increase our enrollment for students who would not be able to participate in our on-campus or our more traditional models. I think you've all heard about the partnership with REUP to bring back students who had started at NIU but left before they completed their degree. And so through that partnership, we have enrolled this spring. We just started in November, so it was a pretty short runway. But as of January, the start of the semester, we had 27 students who had come back, and we have hundreds more who are interested and are currently in the process of figuring out how to navigate that, like when they could come back and if they have challenges that they need to overcome, what degree, if they want to go back into their original degree. So, you know, a lot of interactions with them, but that's another viable strategy that I think we'll continue to see grow and being able to bring those students back to complete an NIU degree. So we have a number of strategies like that, thinking about how to make our programs more accessible and available to different populations. You've heard a lot of conversation about serving adult learners. We're continuing to work in that space and think about the marketing for adult learners, but also thinking about the programs and the wraparound services that we offer. And so we're real excited about some expansion of the Bachelor of General Studies, which is basically an online program that's very appealing to a lot of working adults because it's incredibly flexible for them. But also looking at, we're in the process of standing up a cybersecurity program and then looking at other opportunities. Are there some of our degree programs that if we offered them in a different modality, or we offered them at a different location, or we offered them, in a particular format for a specific group of adult learners, that might make that program accessible to them? And so we're looking through that, as well as, are there additional degree programs that are in high demand that we might need to consider? Is that something that we could add to our portfolio? So always looking at the ways that we can take our NIU degrees and make them more accessible to a wider range of folks.
Okay, just the last few ones. Academic affairs, admin and finance, do it, HR have been doing a lot of work around inefficient processes, cost inefficiencies. So for example, we have a group that we've put together to really look at the cost of technology, the cost of IT, right? We know what we pay for central IT, but there's a lot of distributed IT that we're not as clear on. And so are there opportunities, say, if two offices are buying the same software, where we come together, buy a licensing, then provide it for those two offices, which reduce the software cost and improve that efficiency? And so we started that work in January, if I remember correctly, and hope to have a lot of recommendations out of that come later this spring. We've been working with HR to try and streamline processes. An example would be time entry, which is painful for all of us. And so that opportunity, actually, if we're able to implement it, would result in net savings for what we do, not just in time and effort by all of us, but in actual dollars. And so those are just a couple of examples of things that we're doing. And then last, we're continuing the work around the auxiliaries and how we build a gain share model. So we're working really closely with student affairs, with athletics, to figure out ways that we can increase revenues. What's the proper pricing for conferences and events? How can we incentivize those units to raise more revenue? And then how can they keep it? And then we're beginning that work in what we call the 41s. So the 41s are revenue generating entities. They get their monies through like fee for service, indirect cost recoveries from grants. And so that's been a giant opportunity for us. And we're really starting to look at how we can get that more simple and get more gain sharing, more revenue opportunities there. And then we haven't talked about everybody, right? But OERD, RIFs, ADEI, everyone is working as hard as they can to identify opportunities to either reduce costs or increase revenues. For example, OERD is looking at leasing more space in their Naperville location. And so everybody is working on this. And in many cases, we're all working together, which is actually how we have to do this if we're going to solve the deficit. And I think, last thing, just count and plug, as we spend our resources, let's really be mindful about how we're using that. If it's going to impact a student in a positive way, by all means, we should be spending, right? But if it's just something that we want to do, maybe we hold off this year and maybe not do that. And I think that's when I say thank you and answer, happy to answer any questions that y'all might have.
I'll ask a question. Is there a sense of all of these items taken together about generally, not specific numbers all the way down to the penny or anything, but generally about the progress that's being made?
Yeah,
towards that number.
Great question, Ben. I have a spreadsheet where I've been tracking all the numbers. And so we've identified about $7 million in expenses that we think we can reduce in different ways. And we've identified about $6.5 million of revenues that we think we can generate. Some of these expenses are not going to be this year. They're going to be over the next several years. Some of these revenues are not going to be just this year. They're going to be over the next several years. And so, we're really mindful of the promise that we made to the board, the goal we set with the board. And so we're working really hard to get us there. And if the state comes through, that's another $2 million.
All right. Well, thank you both so much for sharing the updates and for sharing the efforts that are going on across campus. That brings us to item 9, which are reports from the council's boards and standing committees. Up first is the Faculty Advisory Council to the IBAG, report from Linda Saberio. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I think that walk over here may have been longer than my actual report. So the FAC February meeting was conducted entirely via Zoom and was primarily a working meeting. And during the morning reports, Jill from the IBAG mentioned that an AI task force was created at the state level. And she volunteered, good for her, right, to serve as the FAC's liaison. So we're proud of her for volunteering to serve as our liaison on that. She also discussed the numerous rollout challenges to the recently renovated FAFSA site. Just wanted you to be aware of that because it may mean that we see a delay in the rollout of financial aid packages for students, but they are coming. And then we had one guest speaker join us. He's a Dr. Lewis Newman, the former Dean of Academic Advising and Associate Vice Provost for Undergraduate Education at Stanford University, who presented on his book titled Thinking Critically in College. I sound like I'm like plugging his book again, don't I? Like I did at Faculty Senate, right? Dr. Newman discussed like student assumptions about critical thinking, especially first gen students, what it means to think critically, how evidence and experiences relate to critical thinking, metacognition, and how we develop our curriculum to include critical thinking development skills. Actually sounds like a really good book. The afternoon then wrapped up with reports from the working and caucus groups. Next month, I can skip that entire paragraph, by the way, about the higher education funding rollout. Yeah, thank you very much. So next month, we will be meeting here at NIU at the Barsima Alumni and Visitor Center. The meeting is scheduled from 9 to 2:30 p.m. on Friday, March 15th. So if you have nothing better to do on Friday of spring break week, please feel free to join us. Thank you. Any questions?
All right. Thank you, Linda. Next up is the University Advisory Committee to the Board of Trustees, and I'll be giving the report. Thanks to George for sharing the FACFO update. I don't have to redo that. It was the subcommittee. Okay. We met in the subcommittees. In the first meeting of the day, we received a report on sabbaticals and approved sabbaticals for the upcoming academic year, and also received a presentation from Natalie Churick. There was also information and updates related to NIU's emerging HSI status and what that means for campus for all students on campus. During the script the acronyms, but RILA, the research and all the others. I appreciate it. I haven't been involved in enough board of trustees to have them just like that. But the highlight for me of the Board of Trustees day was the Edible Campus presentation, which really highlighted all the efforts that are going on in such a short amount of time and the scale up of those efforts across campus and the ways it's connected to the community, to the campus, and also to more broadly to the region and the state. And it's just, if you don't know about Edible Campus, I really recommend you going to their website, engaging with it and learning about it. It's just really, to me, very exciting. I don't think just to me, I think the board appreciated it. Everybody there was on board with it, and I recommend checking that out. Otherwise, that's my report from the University Advisory Committee of the Board of Trustees. If there's any other additions. Great. Next up, we have no report from Rules, Governance, and Elections Committee. SGA report from Chris English.
Hello. Right now, SGA is going through a lot of the run-up and ramp-up for two big events, or two big things, namely the elections for the SGA, which the all candidate information is due March 1st, and voting days will be March 25th through the 27th, as well as we are starting the process of annual funding. So student orgs are required to request annual funding by March 31st. That way we can figure out how best to fund them and their tier breakdowns. To that end, some of you who are faculty advisors to student organizations or know faculty who are faculty advisors, please let them know to push their student orgs to fill out those forms, because that's how we make sure that they get funded. And to that point, if you are in the offices of your various departments or colleges, you might be getting an email from me. This is to figure out what tiers to put those orgs in. And then finally, no, that's it. So next month, we should have a spending breakdown for you guys. But we're looking like we're going to use almost all of, if not all of, our supplemental that we were given, which is around, I might be misspeaking, but I think it's around 25,000 for the full year. So that all that money has been going to student organizations, and we've been able to successfully fund a bunch of events and other outreach activities through that. So.
Thank you, Chris. Are there any questions? All right. Next up is the Operating Staff Council, and it looks like Jay is going to start the walk early, so I appreciate that.
Good afternoon. I'm Jay Montero, the Vice President of Operating Staff Council. And I think what I'm going to talk about today is going to dovetail nicely with what's been spoken about earlier today. This past week, the Operating Staff Council Scholarship Committee selected four outstanding students to receive the 2024-25 Operating Staff Endowed Dependent Scholarship. The council had been awarding two small scholarships a year starting in about 2004. And this scholarship was endowed in 2011 when we finally reached the initial $25,000 amount that we needed. Since 2011 to date, we have now awarded 28 students over $27,000. The operating staff are committed to our students, And we try to make sure that they have the best experience possible when they come to NIU. And we try to do what we can to ensure that they achieve their goal, which is graduation. And I want to finish today by quoting something that our president said to me this week. She said, "One Husky can do only so much, but the pack can get things done." So, thank you.
Thank you. All right, up next is a Supportive Professional Staff Council report from Felicia Bohannon.
So we have extended our SPSS awards deadline. Actually, that is coming up tomorrow, which is February 29th. We also have our SPSS certificates, the recognition. The deadline for that is March 4th. And the things that are acknowledged by the SPSS certificates include publication of books or articles, presentations, leadership and professional associations, and also honors or recognitions received. And that information is detailed on the SPSS website. In addition to that, our luncheon and awards program will take place on April 3rd. So we're asking you to save the date. That will be our awards luncheon and program. We also, the deadline today is for our SPSS dependent scholarship. And basically we will be awarding two awards this year. One will go to a child or a grandchild of an SPSS employee. And then as previously mentioned, we expanded that to also a second scholarship, which will go to a student who has been mentored or impacted by an SPSS employee. Next week, we will be launching Husky High Five, which is basically a campaign to increase the funds that we're able to give. And so we will be reaching out to employees to give either $5 per pay period, $10 per pay period, $15 per pay period, or $25 per pay period. And they will be acknowledged on April 3rd, and they will receive a pin. Basically, we're launching our Husky High Five campaign. So you'll hear more information about that. Thank you.
Thank you, Felicia. That concludes the reports, which brings us to our informational items under our item six. Just to note, our next meeting is April 3rd. There is not a meeting during March due to spring recess, which then brings us to our adjournment. Do I have a motion to adjourn the meeting? Thank you. TBD. Second, Johnson, all in favor? Thank you.